Happiness is the meaning and purpose of life, the whole aim and end of human existence. That was Aristotle, wrote that in 349 BC, more than 2,300 years ago. Next quote. You must make a mighty effort to keep swimming upward into happiness forever. That's Elizabeth Gilbert, author of Eat, Pray, Love in 2006 AD, 11 years ago. So not much has changed in human history, right? Aristotle, chase happiness, 349 BC. Modern books, chase happiness, 2006 AD. We humans, we are fascinated with satisfaction and fulfillment. We crave what we could call fullness of life. We crave to have a full life. And that's actually a really good thing because the Bible teaches we were created to crave that. And in fact, we weren't created just to crave it, but to get it. We were made by God to experience and have eternal fullness of life. But, as we all know, the Bible also tells us that there's brokenness in this world and there's brokenness in us. And it's radically tangled up our souls in a way that only God can unwind it. Part of our brokenness is our souls get so tangled, we don't even know how to unwind our own souls. Only God can do it. Here's how the Old Testament prophet Jeremiah described the tangled mess in our souls. He wrote this, "The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately sick. Who can understand it?" So that's the Bible's declaration on how the heart operates. Desperately sick, deceitful above all things, who can understand it? I mean, who can understand some of the things you feel at times, right? And what you try to do with what you experience in your inner life, the noise of life and the insecurities that come with that and your fears, and who can understand this thing called the heart? That's what Jeremiah says. And so many people look to things to untangle their souls. Relationships, dating, marriage, family, in view of this God, Marriage, and Family series. And these are awesome gifts. They're awesome gifts of God. But they're not like God in any way. And no matter how good a relationship is in your life or how good it could be, it will never untangle the mess in your soul. You just can't do it with a relationship. Whether it's with kids or with a spouse or with a great friend, the mess is just too deep for another person to untangle. So there's a letter in the New Testament titled Colossians. The Apostle Paul wrote it to his Christian brothers and sisters in a city called Colossae. And these Christians were struggling to find fullness of life just like Aristotle and Elizabeth Gilbert. They were struggling to find fullness of life. What will help me experience satisfying fullness in my life? And so here's what Paul was so eager to share. Fullness of life can only be found in Jesus, and there's nothing greater than Jesus. That's Paul's argument. And I wanted to finish with that, with this series, because it's really good to talk about marriage and family and singleness and relationship status and those things. But there's a danger that the more you talk about anything, whatever it is, the more you might think that the center of my joy and happiness and being and fulfillment is tied up in this, and you kind of miss Jesus, who is fullness of life. So I want to speak in unison with Paul this morning and help us finish this series by being satisfied in the fullness that Jesus brings, in Jesus alone. All right, so let's dig into Paul's instruction to these Colossian Christians, and we're going to start, I think a great place to start would be understanding the problem they were experiencing. So Colossians chapter 2, verses 8 through 10. Colossians 2, 8 through 10. Here's what Paul writes. See to it that no one takes you captive by philosophy and empty deceit, according to human tradition, according to the elemental spirits of the world, and not according to Christ. For in Him the whole fullness of deity dwells bodily, and you have been filled in Him who is the head of all rule and authority. So what this helps us understand about this problem the Colossians were experiencing, there was some sort of a hollow and deceptive philosophy that was raging in the church. And Paul warns them, don't be captured by this. Be careful not to be captured by it. And then he describes it with three phrases. The first phrase was, this philosophy, whatever it is according to human tradition, is what Paul says. And a more literal translation from the Greek is teaching of humans. It's based in the teaching of humans, is what Paul is saying. So what we know is this philosophy or worldview, it was fueled by the conventional wisdom of the surrounding culture. And that's why it was so deceptive and they could be captured by it. So Paul says, this is according with human teaching, which is to say, all around you in the city of Colossae, this is something that people are widely believing. And so because they are, there's a tendency that you're just going to sort of by osmosis take on those beliefs. Okay? The second phrase, Paul says, it's according to the elemental spirits of the world. In the Greek, the phrase elemental spirits is one word. And it means a principle that underlies something. And the principle was likely the four major elements of the earth: earth, air, fire, and water. So biblical scholars, here's what they think. We don't know for sure because Paul doesn't come out and describe this philosophy, but it sounds like it's basically a cocktail of Jewish mysticism and Greek mythology that involved worshiping angels, experiencing hidden truth, and emanations of fullness from a supernatural plane. So I think in our modern language, we would just call it New Agey, is what you call it. It was sort of this, you know, getting in touch with higher power. And if you believe it and you think it and you're optimistic and you go through your life believing it's going to happen, you can know it's going to happen. And it had that vibe to it, that New Agey, mixing a whole bunch of things vibe, okay? The third phrase Paul gives, it was not according to Christ. And all Paul meant was this. What you're believing, guys, it's actually not consistent with Christianity. If we're intellectually honest, these can't even exist together. So it's either Jesus is our fullness, or we get fullness by connecting with these emanations from the supernatural plane and worshiping these angels. And right, so Paul is saying these can't coexist. It's not according to Christ. Now, verses 9 and 10, Paul says something amazing. Listen to verse 9 again. For in Him, the whole fullness of deity dwells bodily. So Paul is saying, Jesus, the man, the entire corpus of God's glory rests in this man. Everything you need to know and see and experience of God, you can find in one place, this man named Jesus. The whole fullness of God is there. And listen to what he says next in verse 10. And you have been filled in Him. Saying, guys, the fullness of God is in Jesus, and you've been filled with Jesus. Why are you looking for emanations from the supernatural plane? Why are you worshiping angels? Right? Now, I know this is a really silly example, but it's tangible to help you get a sense of what was going on. It's like the Colossian Christians were sitting at a dinner table on Thanksgiving Day at a restaurant, and the chef was sending out unending platters of perfectly grilled, 32-ounce, dry-aged, bone-in ribeyes pan-seared in butter and garlic. All right? Unending platters. 32-ounce ribeyes. It's my favorite cut. If you like a KC strip, you don't know good steak. Okay? All right, maybe I don't know good steak, but one of us is wrong. We can talk about it later. But unending platters of ribeyes or KC strips, 32-ounce, bone-in, butter, and everything, right? But during the meal, a shady street vendor bursts into the room and starts running a con. And he convinces all of them, you guys are missing out on the really good stuff. You don't know what you're missing, guys. So he lures them from the dinner table out of the room, and they forget the taste and smell of the steak. They forget the taste and smell of the steak. Then he starts selling them black market hot dogs made with rat meat. And he says the weird flavor is an acquired taste that only the refined really enjoy. And they're all like, oh, I want to be refined. I don't want to be that guy who doesn't like the rat dog. So, sure, I'll eat it with you because that's what the refined do, right? That's what is happening. There's this influential leaders who are convincing people to move away from Jesus and saying, no, this is where it's at. And if you were really culturally in vogue, you'd understand that this is just what people do. Now, I know that's really ridiculous, but let me ask you this question. How many times have you stumbled away from the goodness, wisdom, and fullness of Jesus to eat a steaming pile of rat dog rubbish from the world's crock pot? How many times have you done that? How many times have you tasted the fullness of Jesus? All of your sin, past, present, and future, is forgiven. The whole fullness of God dwells in a man. That man died for you and gave you his spirit, so the fullness of God dwells in you. How often have you stumbled away from that because you're following a street vendor eating the black market rat dog? Right? That's us. We do that. We forget the smell and the taste of Jesus, of his gospel. And so we eat things that are inferior. That's what's happening to the Colossians. They've been duped. They've been duped to believe that beyond Jesus, there's something more refined, more spiritual, more culturally in vogue, and more satisfying. Something beyond Jesus. So Paul wants them to understand there's nothing greater than Jesus, and that's why we have Colossians chapter 1, verses 15 to 20. These are probably the most powerful verses in the New Testament on the greatness of Jesus. Colossians 1, 15 to 20. So my goal this morning, if you're coming in here, and maybe you got some rat dog flavor in your mouth, just from the world, that I would help you smell and taste the ribeye again, right? That you'd sense the greatness of Jesus from his word, and you'd go back to the dinner table and say, I don't know why I ever walked away from this dinner table. Colossians 1, 15 to 20. Here's what we read. He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For by him all things were created, in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities, all things were created through him and for him. And he is before all things, and in him all things hold together. And he is the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, that in everything he might be preeminent. For in him all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether on earth or in heaven, making peace by the blood of his cross. I want to handle these verses by pointing out phrases in these verses to put this together for you. So in verse 15, two phrases I want you to see. The first was this: image of the invisible God. Listen, when you meet Jesus in the four Gospels, you are meeting God. He is the image of the invisible God. When you read about Jesus teaching and healing and rebuking and correcting in the full breadth of Jesus' emotional range, everything from hugging tax collectors to whipping Pharisees out of the temple to dying on a cross to praying at night to stilling the calming seas, when you meet Jesus in the Gospels, you are meeting God. Okay? Second phrase, firstborn. I want to clarify something here. I'm not going to get to the Greek word because let's not talk about that. It's just useless academic knowledge. I'll just say this. This is not firstborn in the sense that Jesus was created. Jesus was never created. Jesus has always lived in eternity past with Father and Spirit. The Trinity has always existed. God lives in perfect, self-giving community. He didn't create out of need. He created out of overflow. He didn't create because he was lonely. He created because he's generous. Because he's a Trinity. And so Jesus was never created. The mystery is that the second person of the Trinity was put inside of a baby. But he wasn't created. So when it says firstborn, what Paul is saying is before the first star ever began burning, Jesus was there. Before the first star was set in the sky, Jesus has always been, always is, always will be. So that's verse 15. Verse 16, there's three phrases. Here's the first phrase. Paul says, by him all things were created. Here's the best way of putting it. Jesus designed all the concept art for the creation of the universe. For it to say that by him all things were created, Jesus designed all the concept art. Here's what a sun would look like. Here's what a star will be. Second phrase, through him all things were created. Jesus is the power by which creation happened. Jesus is more powerful than nuclear fusion. Jesus holds nuclear fusion in his hands. Stars burn because Jesus exists. By him and through him. The third phrase in verse 16, this was maybe the most astounding. All things were created for him. So it's like all of creation has a signature in the bottom right corner, like a painting. And the signature on everything in creation is Jesus, and this world is the gallery. And when you walk through this world, everything was made by and through and for Jesus. Everything. It's all for him. Everything proclaims his majesty and his glory. Your family proclaims that. You proclaim that. Air and sunshine and stars and rolling seas and big leafy trees and empty winter trees and everything in creation has the signature of Jesus on it because it's for him. One phrase in verse 17. In him, all things hold together, Paul writes. Without Jesus, every molecule in the world unravels. He is the power that holds together creation. His presence makes H2O stay H2O. Without Jesus, it's just one H and two O's and nothing. Jesus holds creation together. In him, all creation's held together. So in verses 16 and 17, just those two verses, process this. By him, through him, for him, in him. Jesus is the dreamer of all creation. He's the catalyst through which all of it was made. He's the artist whose signature's on everything and the sustainer of everything. That's Jesus. The fullness of God dwells in Jesus. That's who Jesus is. To get clarity on Trinitarian theology, The Father is like the architect. He builds the plan and the blueprints. Then Jesus dreams up all the concept art. And through him it's made, and for him it's made, and in him it's held together. And then at his ascension, he sends the Holy Spirit, and the Holy Spirit does all the hands-on work. This morning as I'm preaching, if you're experiencing affinity in your heart toward this Jesus, it's the work of the Spirit. He's the hands-on worker who's in your heart doing the work. He does the work of transformation. The Holy Spirit does. Now, there's a division of thought between verses 17 and 18, because starting in verse 18, Paul's going to talk about redemption. So Paul has been arguing Jesus is supreme over all creation. Now he's going to argue Jesus is supreme over all redemption. So verse 18 starts with this. He says, "And he is the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, that in everything he might be preeminent." The church is God's chosen people for proclaiming and embodying redemption. That's our call. This morning, I've started a new routine. I joined Planet Fitness. It's been great. It's like a whole new planet full of fitness. And I work out there on Sunday mornings now. It's been really good. I get up and I go to the gym first thing on Sunday. So the first thing I do is not come here. And that's been really helpful. And I was thinking to myself this morning of Paul's words, "Imitate me as I imitate Christ." Imitate me as I imitate Christ. That's what Paul says. Paul says, whoever you are, look at my life. If you'll imitate my life, I will point you to the greatness of Jesus. I was just thinking about that in the context of our church family and my three young boys and a world lost in sin. Can I say that? Can I say, imitate me as I imitate Christ? We're the church. Our call is to proclaim and embody the redemption of Jesus, and Jesus is leading the charge. He is the head of the church. He's the head of this redemptive people. Firstborn from the dead, Jesus is resurrected. Jesus is humanity 2.0. We are still version 1.0. We're old Apple software. We have lots of bugs. We don't work right. We're Windows XP, or no, the one before that that was really bad. Vista! We're Windows Vista. We're broken. Jesus is humanity 2.0. And the good news of Jesus is if you trust Jesus, when your hardware breaks down, you will get Jesus's eternal hardware, so you will not miss anything good for the next 100 trillion years and more. But for now, you and I are 1.0. Until we get turned into 2.0. But Jesus is already there. He's the firstborn from the dead. Verse 19. Listen to how Paul writes this in verse 19. "For in him all the fullness of God is pleased to dwell." The fullness of God is not scattered around between Jesus and other philosophies and ideas and self-help theories and positive thinking paradigms and various world religions and worldviews. The complete and total fullness of God Almighty is pleased to dwell in one place, Jesus. All of it, all of God's fullness is in a man who speaks and sees and hears, and when you go see him face to face, will hold you. The fullness of God who spoke all this into existence has hands and feet. And he can wipe your tears off your face. That's what Paul's saying. And in verse 20, Paul writes this, "And through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether on earth or in heaven, making peace by the blood of his cross." Jesus is in the process of reconciling. Here's how we could say it. Sin has touched every corner of Jesus' wonderful creation. I am full of it. You are full of it. We have sin, capital S sin. Not like we commit sins. I mean, there's something wrong with us. Like Jeremiah would say, the heart is deceptively wicked and it's sick. There's a sickness in me. There's a sickness that wants to harbor resentment. There's a sickness that hates forgiveness at times. There's a sickness that doesn't want to love, and I don't want to be patient. And I don't want to love you. I want to love me. I want to love me. I want to spend my money on me. I want to be about me. I don't want to carry your suffering. I don't want to hear your story. Keep your story. I'd like to be happy. My flesh feels that. Without Jesus, that's all of us. Without the grace of God, even in unbelievers, to desire to serve and help other people, that is our condition because of the curse of sin. And there's one way that Jesus is touching every corner of creation to redeem it. And the answer is the blood of his cross. That's it. The blood of his cross is how redemption is happening. So let's put all this together. Here's who Jesus is. Image of God, eternally existing, all things created by him, through him, for him, and held together in him, head of the church, humanity 2.0, preeminent and supreme over all creation and redemption, fullness of God dwelling in him and only him, reconciling his wayward creation to himself by his life, death, and resurrection. That's Jesus. That's who he is. The fullness of God dwells in a man who looks like us, except he's Middle Eastern. So if you have ethnocentrism issues, a little 5-foot-tall Arabian-looking man will hug you in heaven. He is Jesus. And he doesn't lose his ethnicity. All tribes, all tongues, all languages. An Iranian-looking man is in heaven right now with holes in his hands and holes in his feet, and the fullness of God is in his skin. And that's who's waiting on you. And that's who died for you. Now, what does that mean for us this morning? Because that's nice, high gospel theology of who Jesus is. But how's that touch my life now? Colossians 2, verses 13 and 14, our last little passage here. Here's what Paul writes in Colossians 2, 13 and 14. And you who were dead in your trespasses and the uncircumcision of your flesh, God made alive together with him, having forgiven us all our trespasses by canceling the record of debt that stood against us with its legal demands. This he set aside, nailing it to the cross. Man, the image here is glorious. The word canceling in the Greek has a connotation to it. And the connotation is this. In Paul's day, they wrote on something called papyrus. It was modern day paper at that point. You took reeds and you softened them and smashed them up and dried them out in sheets of paper. And it was expensive and it was in short supply. So once you wrote something on papyrus, there was a process for cleansing it so you could rewrite on there, because you don't waste paper in Paul's day. You keep all your pieces of foil and string and everything else and your papyrus. Okay? And so the image of canceling the record of debt is an image of taking a sheet of papyrus on which is written all of your and my failures to keep the legal demands of God's law. And they are many. They are so many. I mean, I think about in the book of James, James writes this. He says, not only is it sin when you do something you shouldn't do, but when you see something you ought to do and don't do it, that sin too. And you read the book of the law, that's why Leviticus is still helpful for us New Testament Christians. Fortunately, you know, we don't have to go sacrifice pigeons and bulls and goats and lambs. But the point of reading Leviticus today is to recognize God is holy and righteous and perfectly just, and all these laws are an extension of His perfection and His bright, white, hot holiness. All of our failures to keep God's law written on papyrus, Paul says, God has taken some sort of a solution and rubbed it on there, and there's nothing written. You don't have a rap sheet in Jesus. Like, it's not like your sin is in front of God and He just decides to not hold you against it. It's gone. It's erased. Not just what happened last year, but sins you'll commit in 3 years God already knows about, and they're already off your sheet. Never to be written on again. And how was this record of debt canceled? By nailing it to the cross. So in Galatians 3, Paul says, Jesus became a curse for you, which means Jesus took responsibility for your and my failures, and He became our failures. Paul doesn't just say that Jesus like held our failures here. Jesus became a curse. He absorbed your and my failures and became the ugliest thing spiritually you could ever see on the cross. And He did this willingly as a member of the Trinity. As Hebrews 12 says, for the joy set before Him, He embraced the suffering of the cross to redeem you and me. He became this curse, and God's justice fell on Him, and He was crucified, and the record of debt was wiped clean. If you know Jesus in faith. So here's what Paul is saying to these believers in Colossae, and here's what I wanted to say to you. So Jesus, image of the invisible God, preeminent over all things made by Him, through Him, for Him, in Him, head of the church, humanity 2.0, fullness of God dwelling in Him, this Jesus embraced the cross, became a curse for us, was crucified to wipe us clean. And you think you're going to find fullness of life somewhere else? Why are we looking? The fullness of God is in a man. That man sent His Spirit and put it in you, who died for you and wiped it clean. Like, why is that not enough? Why are we looking for fullness in relationship, career, money, problem-free life, avoiding conflict, the great retirement, the vacation we feel like we always need, like just list. In fact, there's a philosopher, I forget his name. Here's how he described the human heart. He called it the infinite pit. He said, you get everything in the world and throw it in the human heart, and it always falls and never hits the bottom. Your heart will never fill up because of the world. Come to Planet Fitness with me. Let's do ab workouts. You will look like Thor, Chris Hemsworth, infinite pit. Stick that in the pit of your heart, it never hits the bottom. It will never satisfy you. Take a vacation every week. Quit your job. Win the lottery. Have the perfect marriage and your kids never go wayward. You will not be content. Infinite pit. Everything just falls forever. Because an infinite pit can only be filled by an infinite person. It's Jesus. It's the fullness of Jesus. The fullness of God dwells in you if you're a believer. Why have you left the dinner table to go eat the rat dogs? Let's all go back to the dinner table. Let's love Jesus. Let's feast on Jesus. That's what Paul was saying to the Colossians. That's what was wrong with the church and how he was helping them. And I wanted to finish the series this way just to say this. I so desperately want your and my relationships to constantly be better. But something I've learned is whether it's Ashley and I or my kids or any relationship, I'll feel like we've progressed somewhere and then life happens or something goes on and I see a new darkness to my heart or somebody else's heart and I'm like, I thought we were getting somewhere. I thought we were above this and beyond this. I thought we'd already done this before. Guys, that's life. That cycle's going to happen until you die. We'll be saying forever, I thought we were done with this on your deathbed. You're not done with it. We are cursed by sin. Some of us in this room are going to die of cancer. It's going to happen. Someone's going to die in car wrecks. Some of us, our spouse is going to get Alzheimer's, not going to know us anymore. Some of us are going to be destitute. Some of us will be very successful and incredibly lonely. It's like Jim Carrey's quote, I wish everyone would get rich and famous so they'd know it's not the answer. The fullness of God is in Jesus. Jesus sent you His Spirit. And if you believe in Jesus, the fullness of the eternal God, you are filled in Him. Let's feast on Jesus. He's our hope. He's our life. If you're out of the rhythm of prayer or out of the rhythm of the Word, I'm not saying this to guilt you because I will join you. I'm just saying we're missing out on the feast. We're missing out on the only thing that can fill the infinite pit. Where everything in your life can go right and I could meet with you and sit down and talk and we will find all sorts of discontentment in your life. Where nothing went wrong and you're still not happy. Because we just throw the great abs and the lottery ticket in the pit and it just keeps falling. Fullness in Jesus. I want us to work on our relationships, but set our hope in Jesus. Your marriage, your kids, your friendships, your singleness, everything here, it'll never get good enough that it satisfies you. Let's work on it, but let's root our hope in Jesus. He is it. By Him, through Him, for Him, in Him. Jesus.